David Goldwin is president of Goldwin International Strategies, LLC, an international energy consulting firm. It's offering advice on issues such as political risk, economic sanctions, and corporate social responsibility. He's a senior fellow in the energy program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., CISES, and he serves on the Council of Foreign Relations Task Force on Energy Security. So please help me welcome David Goldwin.
Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a little bit humbling to talk about this issue when you look at the audience and see that there's more talent out there than there is up on the stage, but I'll do my best. I want to talk about six things this morning: what energy poverty is, why you ought to care, what causes it, how we ought to address it, what developed countries can do, and then in the spirit of the Aspen Ideas Fest, one big idea I have about energy poverty. What's the problem? Well, today the problem is about 1.6 billion people in the world have no access to electricity, and about 2.4 billion of them cook with traditional fuels. Traditional fuels are things like wood and dung. The third thing is that energy prices are swamping development gains. It says that people in developing world spend about a quarter of their cash income on energy. And the other big problem with energy poverty is that countries who try to address it have a hard time doing it in a big way, in a way that's not harmful to the climate. The two largest consumers of coal in the world are China and India. No surprise, it's the cheapest way to provide electricity. So it's a very complex problem. Why should you care? Well, first you should care because of where the energy poor are. 80% are in South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. Four out of five of them are in the rural areas, but it's becoming increasingly urbanized. And half the number of people are in China and India, but as a percentage, a lot of these people are in southern Sub-Saharan Africa. You need to care for a few reasons. One is security. People who are completely disconnected from the economy are often not happy, or at least easy to exploit externally, easy to exploit by their own governments because they have no political voice. You should care economically because as Americans, at least, we spend, you know, billions of dollars over the years on economic development, but all that we spend on development is swamped by rising energy prices and by the fact that unless you bring electricity to people, they cannot create economic activity. They also can't have decent health care. Women spend probably, you know, four-fifths of their time carrying wood from one place to another in these parts of the world. So you can't take care of health, you can't take care of the economy without dealing with these issues. And in countries that try to help the poor by subsidies, countries like Nigeria, you have demand which far exceeds what it would be if there was some reasonable price. So it actually accelerates global demand for oil. A social reason you ought to care is that energy poverty is a major cause of death, and I'll show you a picture of why that's so. And the final one is environmental, which is that people who have to burn wood or coal or dung for their own needs create some emissions. Countries that are trying to scale these problems that use coal are creating huge emissions also. And that's why we saw last year that, you know, coal was the greatest source increased source of supply in the world for energy demand. In the United States and in the developing world, people are turning to coal, and so we're not making much progress on the environmental front. This is a picture, sorry for those of you on the radio who can't see it, but it's a map of the world with different colors on it that shows electricity consumption per capita. It's just a quick way of showing that for those in the audience who are looking at the light green and the dark green countries, you can see here, again, the countries which have very little consumption per capita of electricity aren't the most efficient countries in the world. It's because they have no access for large parts of their population, and that's Africa and South Asia. If you had that last picture in your mind, here's another map of the world that shows Human Development Index rankings. And in the red and the yellow are people who have low human development or medium human development. And it's another way of just showing you that those without access to electricity, without decent health care, are at the bottom end of the human development scale. And those are significantly in Africa, far worse in Africa than any place else, and also in South Asia. And that's just a way of showing that there are entire countries in Africa that are essentially energy poor, while there are large populations in China and India that are poor, while other parts of the population have access to electricity. This is a slide that shows you that poverty kills. It shows number of deaths from different diseases. And smoke from biomass kills more people than malaria. And the number of people using biomass in 2030 is expected to grow, not shrink. We have a presidential initiative on malaria, but we don't have anything on energy poverty. And it's actually a bigger killer. It's a really hard problem to fix. This slide shows a picture of a Nigerian pipeline exploding. And you look at Nigeria and you think, here's a country that is rich in oil but has no gasoline and imports all its gasoline. It flares natural gas, but it has virtually no electric power. The power company used to be called NEPA, National Electric Power Authority, which Nigerians said stood for No Electric Power Always. They've done a lot of restructuring, and now they call it the Power Holding Company of Nigeria. Nigerians saying that stands for Problem Has Changed Name. And you look at Nigeria, and what happens? It is one of the cheapest places in the world to buy gasoline, yet they have refineries which don't function because you can't make money refining gasoline. Second, people steal the gasoline because you can steal it and you can sell it, and you have literally thousands of people who have died from tapping into these pipelines, partially for their own use, but partially so they can sell it across the border. And Nigeria has tried to liberalize gasoline prices, and what happens? It shuts down the country. Even last week, they tried to raise it from basically 51 cents a liter to 58 cents a liter. And two of the major unions in the country decided they were going to shut down production and try and shut down the economy. And this has happened over and over again in Nigeria. So you have an incredibly complex problem, which is if you try and use the price mechanism, then you have an immense social dislocation. So what's at the root of this energy poverty problem? In most places, it's lack of infrastructure, not lack of resources. And this is Nigeria or Bolivia. They've got gas or they've got oil, but they don't have the transmission, the distribution, or the refineries, or the power generation to provide electricity. It's lack of investment, not lack of capital, because people are putting money into these countries. They're just not putting it to power generation because people don't pay for electricity, and so they can't make any money doing it. A third problem is poor governance and corruption, and we could do a whole lecture on this, but there are people who have a stake in rules which don't work. There are people who have a stake in limiting, you know, the people who can build generation in a company. There are people who have a stake in making sure that oil or gas is scarce if you have an ability to distribute it and earn significant rents. And countries who have money are not spending their own money dealing with their energy poverty problem, and that's a result of poor governance and corruption. And the distorted policy environment, I'll just mention, since David Dollar is here from the World Bank, he knows more about that than I do. But if you don't have an environment where you can attract investment, where you can do transactions in some sort of a clean fashion, and where you reduce subsidies, then you're not going to solve this problem. So what are the prescriptions? The first ones are really to get prices right. And this is another way of saying this is stop subsidizing the rich. If gasoline is cheap for everybody in the country, even the rich people get subsidized. Make the rich people pay the market price, subsidize the poor. Hard to do, but not impossible. Second is use appropriate technologies, and this is the Amory Lovins kit book, basically, because you can't just build the grid for entire countries, nor do you need to. You can use things like micro-hydro, distributed generation. You don't have to build a grid to the entire country. You can bring electricity to places where it isn't, and you can also offer a concession for a lucrative part of the city and make that concessionaire provide rural electricity as part of the price. You can cross-subsidize things. So there are ways to do it, but one size doesn't fit all. You have to in an environment where you permit investment, allowing independent power production to come in so people can come in from the outside and use private capital, not just the government's money, in order to build this generation and give them a decent return. And finally, build sustainable solutions. And this is both making sure that if you are outside, you don't just build the power plant and leave. You have to be able to build the capacity in countries for them to be able to operate the plants or the water projects or whatever you do, because a lot of projects have been built and failed because countries don't know how to operate them when people leave. So what should developed countries do? Really, the first thing that we can do as developed countries in the United States is heal ourselves, because the big driver for technologies is going to come from carbon constraints from the developed countries. If we have a carbon-constrained economy, we are going to be working to find these technological solutions. You're not going to expect Rwanda to invest $1 billion to find some distributed generation. It's going to come out of the U.S. or it's going to come out of the U.K. We're going to drive that technology. If we are not constraining our carbon, that technology doesn't get driven. They don't have those solutions. Second is promote responsible investment. And that's working with China to make sure we adhere to some standards on when you lend to a country that you adhere to some appropriate environmental standards, anti-corruption standards. Promote efficiency and regional integration. There are estimates that 15 to 45% of the existing power generation in these countries is wasted, and we from the outside can do a lot to help people harmonize their regulations, wheel electricity across the border. We can work with China. Again, that's a talk for a whole subject, but we have more in common with China in promoting development and stability in this part of the world than anyone else. Support the bank and the fund of their policy reform, and expand financing for infrastructure and efficiency. The IEA estimates it's $200 billion to address this problem. It's less than one Iraq war, so I think it's something we can probably afford. And last, one big idea. This is a problem that's been around for a while, and there are lots of solutions, but if we as Americans want to change the way we are viewed in the world, then my one big idea is that the next president of the United States ought to make ending energy poverty their big idea, that is our way to reach out to the world to bring something that helps other people, which is good for us, which is good for them, which uses our capital, which uses our technology, which lets us not go it alone and partner with other people, but can actually make this a better world. So they can call it power to the people, they can call it bringing light to the masses for the evangelicals, they can call it what they want, but this is a problem I think we can address, and the next president ought to address it. Thank you.
Thanks, David. I want to remind everyone again for the first time that this session is being broadcast by Aspen Public Radio. I next want to introduce David Dollar. David heads the China office of the World Bank. He's an authority on the effects of globalization. He has served as the bank's director of development policy and has headed the microeconomics and growth group in its research development. He also serves as the bank's country director for Mongolia and a policy advisor to Vietnam. Please welcome David Dollar.
Thank you, David. I'm very happy that Chevron and the Aspen Institute are thinking about our energy future, and I'm very pleased to be invited to speak on this panel. The question that we're trying to address is how energy affects economic development and global stability, and I enjoyed the first David's presentation very much. I agree largely with the ideas he presented. I'm going to try to supplement that, and I just want to make three points to help start off our conversation. The first point I want to make is that globalization is increasing the demand for energy. I think the way that this is happening is that globalization has accelerated the growth rate of the global economy. The last decade has been one of the best decades of economic growth that the world has seen in a long time. And it's not just that the world economy is growing faster, but the nature of that growth has changed. You know, up until 20 years ago, the most rapid growth was always in the already developed parts of the world, such as Western Europe, Japan, and the United States. And starting sometime around 20 years ago and accelerating in the 1990s, the fastest growth in the world is now occurring in the developing world. China is the best example of this. You know, I live in Beijing, so I'm sitting in the middle of this, but China is not the only example of this. India has been growing quite rapidly, some parts of Latin America. Last year, Sub-Saharan Africa grew at 6%, which is the best year of economic growth that Sub-Saharan Africa has had for a long time. And one of the things that's driving this faster growth in the developing world is the process of urbanization and industrialization. Now, the positive side of this faster growth in the developing world is that this has brought about a very dramatic poverty reduction in the past 20 years. You know, up until about 1980, the number of absolute poor in the world kept growing, and then that reversed itself early in the 1980s, and the number of poor people has declined by about 50%, while world population keeps growing. So this is a very impressive development, and one of the things the first David talked about is there are still important groups in sub-Saharan Africa, in some parts of the world, that are not participating in this, and I agree with him that getting their involvement is important, but the growth that we already see in the developing world has accelerated demand for energy, and getting more poor people involved is going to increase that demand even further. So what we've seen in the past 10 years is a pretty sharp increase in the demand for energy. Most of that demand is met by fossil fuels. The supply of these, you know, oil, gas, these fossil fuels, this supply is basically fixed. It's being used up, so we have a contracting supply. And not surprisingly, with rising demand and contracting supply, we've seen a very large increase in the price of oil and gas and even coal in the recent period. So big developing countries like China and India are looking at this situation, and they're very worried about energy supplies and about their needs for energy. They're worried about the availability of supply. They're also worried about the fact that burning the fossil fuel is creating greenhouse gases, and the best estimates now are that the world climate is going to get quite a bit hotter, and that's going to have quite significant negative effects for the world economy. So I think my first general point is that globalization has had a lot of positive effects on development, but it's accelerating demand for energy. Most of that is being met from fossil fuels, and as a world, we've got a pretty big issue about how we manage this energy future, both the supplies of energy and also the issue of greenhouse gas emissions and global warming. Now, the second point I want to make is that, in general, in my view, most developing countries are setting themselves on an energy inefficient development path, and this is quite ironic given this situation of energy scarcity in the world. Given my first point, I think it's somewhat ironic that many countries are putting themselves on an energy inefficient development path. And the way this happens, this is my sense of how this happens. Countries like India, China, other developing countries that are doing very well, doing relatively well, they understand the importance of energy for their development. They're reluctant to price it appropriately. They tend to underprice it. Now, economists can disagree about what is exactly the right price for energy, but personally, I support the approach we see in Western Europe and Japan, an approach that says that using fossil fuels has lots of negative effects. It makes your economy dependent on supplies of a resource that are dwindling. It creates local air pollution, and it emits greenhouse gases. So personally, I tend to favor a pretty high taxation of energy products in order to reflect those negative spillovers, or what we economists call negative externalities. But developing countries are very reluctant to price energy appropriately. The United States does not buy into the kind of approach we see in Europe or Japan. Countries like India, China, many developing countries in Latin America tend to price energy even lower than the United States. So in many places in the developing world, you've got relatively low prices for energy, encouraging firms and households to use more energy than they really need. I don't want to overwork the pricing issue because there are other important issues. The second important issue I think here is what I call standards for automobiles, but probably more importantly, standards for buildings. And what I see living in China is that they're pretty good energy efficiency standards for buildings on paper, but in general, they're often ignored in the construction and the use of buildings. This is very important. China is growing so rapidly that half of all the buildings that will exist in 2015 have not been built yet. And if you travel around China, you see, you know, people joke the national bird of China is the crane, because in every city you go to, you see massive amounts of construction. You see this in India to a slightly lesser extent than China. You see it in many parts of Latin America. Huge construction boom going on as urbanization proceeds. Most of these buildings will be used for 40 years or longer, and if they're built now with very poor standards, then you're going to have one energy future. And if, on the other hand, you build cars and buildings with much stricter standards now, you're going to have a different kind of energy future. So I see many developing countries putting themselves on a somewhat inefficient energy path. You can see this in the data. You know, China uses about twice as much energy to produce a dollar of PPP GDP compared to Japan or Western Europe. So China's using a lot more energy to produce output than the more developed countries. India has even lower energy efficiency than China. So we see this all over the developing world. So we have the inefficient development path, energy inefficient path. At the same time, I see some countries trying to lock in supply. You know, India is trying to make various deals to lock in supply from different countries, Iran, for example. China is well known as investing in Sudan and Angola and trying to lock in supply. And my own personal view is that the effort to lock in supply is a failed strategy. There are only a few really major producers of oil and gas. You know, basically Russia, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait. There are only a few major producers. Everybody else is pretty minor. So if you lock in supply from a minor producer, it has very little effect in the world market. You know, if China buys a little bit of oil from Sudan, that takes a little pressure off the market so Japan can buy oil from Venezuela. It doesn't have any real effect. So I think the notion of locking in supply, in my view, is somewhat illusory. This is really a global issue of the total supply and what kind of development path we're going to put the world economy on. Now, my third point, very briefly, is that I do think it's in the interest of developing countries to get on a more energy-efficient path, and I think it's in the interest of developing countries to participate in some kind of global scheme to control greenhouse gas emissions. Developing countries, many of them realize the importance of energy efficiency. In China, as part of its new 5-year plan, the Chinese have set an extremely ambitious energy efficiency target. They want to increase the energy efficiency of the economy by 20% in 5 years, which is quite ambitious. But in the first year of their plan, they only made a 1% improvement. So they're far off target in meeting their energy efficiency plan. And you find this around the developing world, a lot of good intentions about increasing energy efficiency, but not a whole lot of progress. Now, I do link that back to the issue of standards and prices. And it's one thing to announce a target, but if you actually want firms and households to change their behavior, raising prices is the most obvious way to do it. And then setting standards and enforcing them seriously is also important. Some of these countries, India, China, they're so big that they could have a very significant effect on technological advance if they would set what I call stretch standards. So if India and China set standards of energy efficiency for automobiles that are well beyond what we have now, all the car companies in the world would compete to create new technologies in order to serve that market. So I think there's a great opportunity to use the levers of prices and standards to get technological advance, and that's really going to be the best hope for meeting the energy future in a secure way. Now, the last point I want to make within this third point concerns the whole issue of greenhouse gases and global warming. You may have read one estimate has just put China ahead of the U.S. as the largest annual emitter of greenhouse gases. Certainly, the emissions from developing countries are growing rapidly because these countries, their economic growth is so rapid because it's driven by industrialization. Most of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, most of the stock of greenhouse gases, was put there by the already developed countries like the United States, Western Europe, and Japan. But the current flow of greenhouse gas emissions is going to be coming increasingly from the developing world. Now, at the moment, we have a very imperfect international regime in which a number of wealthy countries, Japan, Western Europe, have signed up to commitments to reduce emissions, but they're able to meet those commitments by purchasing carbon reductions from the developing world. And China has emerged as the largest seller in this market, so China's making quite a bit of money selling emission reductions in the current Kyoto framework. But that all comes to an end in 2012, and I think there's a serious risk that we won't be able to negotiate a comprehensive agreement post-Kyoto. And that's going to put us in a very unfortunate world where I think the emissions of greenhouse gases are not going to be checked. The best estimates are that developing countries will be the big losers from global warming. So you get a lot of political posturing in the developing world saying that basically you rich people created the problem and you should pay to clean it up. I have some sympathy for that point of view. I do think it's in the interest of the United States to play a leading role in developing a new international regime for controlling greenhouse gases. But I think it's in the interest of developing countries to participate, and if they're not willing to make some commitments, then probably we will not get some kind of global system. So if I could end with my one big idea, which has been put out by other people, so I don't want to claim originality, but I think it's a good big idea to talk about, is if we're going to control greenhouse gas emissions, the logical approach is to set a global target. We can argue a little bit about what that is, but something like reducing the emissions by 50% by 2040 or something like that, And then, to me, the fair, obvious fair system is to allocate the rights to emit per capita across the whole world. Basically say everybody has equal rights to the atmosphere. And if you set up that kind of regime, what you would get in the short run is you would get rich Americans paying Africans a significant amount of money in order to get their emission rights, in order to, under this kind of scheme, you would get some reduction in the U.S., but you wouldn't necessarily get a 40 or 50% reduction of emission in the already developed countries. You would be buying some space from the developing world to emit a little bit beyond that. This could be an interesting scheme that would could finance a lot of development in the developing world. It would definitely impose costs on the rich countries, but it would be recognizing that there have to be costs involved in addressing this problem of greenhouse gases. So that's my one big idea, is we should be thinking about some kind of global system for capping the greenhouse gas emissions. We should have a tradable system which will establish a price for emissions, and that will drive a lot of the technological change. If you then sort of think about what this world would look like, people will invent new technologies to sequester carbon, we'll get improvements in solar technologies, we'll get improvements in wind technologies. I think technological advance is the best hope, but I think we need to use prices in the market system in order to create the incentives for these kind of technological developments. So in closing, I think we can think of two energy futures, one in which we don't get much progress in energy efficiency, we get a lot of competition among major economies to try to lock up supply of oil and gas, potentially we could see a lot of conflict around that. And then I see a more harmonious future in which as a world, we create the right incentives to invent new technologies, reduce the use of carbon, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and that would be a world where we have a lot of coordination to try to address energy issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. The Crown Fellowship at the Aspen Institute had a reunion here with the Crown Act II. And part of the class from Nigeria, from the African Leadership Initiative, and from Ghana were here. And I was with the Ghana class in Ghana about a month ago. And as you know, Ghana has an energy crisis. They're largely dependent on hydro for their electricity, owing to the dam to Lake Volta and a large electricity generation power plant there. But the water level has receded and has not been replenished, and so they're not able to drive all the generators in the dam as efficiently as they have in the past. Recently, just before the reason I mentioned the Crown reunion, is a week before that, oil was discovered off of the coast of Ghana. And so we talked about this a little bit, and there was a sense that at best, for those who were from Nigeria, from Ghana, from other developing nations in Africa, as an example, only as an example, that oil was a mixed blessing at best, and what Jeffrey Sachs may have called a resource curse at the worst. And so, David, I may start with you. There is this question now about having natural resources as a part of your economic assets, but being unable to translate that into the general good. What is it that is the obstacle, either from a geopolitical strategy or point of view or economic point of view, that is the key obstacle from allowing countries like Ghana, looking at this new resource, to move forward into a progressive, democratic way of using that energy?
Well, the two greatest problems in Ghana and Nigeria and other places are weak and poor governance and a lack of transparency. And they're two different problems. The governance issue is that when you have a lot of resources coming into a government that has not had to, either has not had to tax or has not had to manage large sums, they're not necessarily capable of doing it. And so the first thing that happens is a rush of rent seekers saying, I know how to spend this money. And then people say, I know how to steal this money. And then a lot of not very well thought on ideas about how to use it for development. The flip side of that is the lack of transparency, which is when governments are not obliged to be public to their citizens about how much money they're taking in, what the system is for taking in that money, how fast it will come in, and where it goes, then you have two bad things happen. One is it's easy for the money to disappear and be misspent, and the other is that even if the government is weak to begin with, it begins to atrophy, because when the government doesn't need to tax its citizens in order to be accountable to stay in power, then it tends to marginalize them. And so for Ghana, Ghana has some real functioning institutions, so it is better positioned than most countries who have discovered oil to be able to manage these resources. But it does need to act now. The oil probably won't come for 7 or 8 years, to build in the systems of transparency to make sure that people know who's got the contract, what the bonus was, when the money's coming in, and who's getting it.
Okay. Now, Africa has its own unique vulnerabilities, and David, I know that you're working in Beijing. The contrast for us, if you will, the differences between the challenges for the vulnerable nations in sub-Saharan Africa with that of this dynamic, growing economy of China in terms of energy.
Well, I think, you know, you've got some very resource-rich countries in Africa, and you have some countries that are not particularly resource-rich. China is not a resource-rich country, so I think the sort of analogy is more appropriate for the African countries that are not resource-rich. And, you know, as the first David was talking about, they want to get on the bandwagon of urbanization, electrification. They want to raise living standards, so they want to get involved in this first stage where your, you know, use of energy goes up quite dramatically. I think I'm not an expert on Africa. I've done a little bit of work there. You know, my sense is the biggest difference between African countries and Chinese economy is what I call the investment climate. You know, the remarkable thing about China is there are many cities now where it's very easy to start a private firm. Infrastructure works well. The ports are world class. Customs administration is very efficient. And I don't see that many locations in Africa that are creating this kind of good production platform. But then I think the other African countries have a lot of resources. They have the potential to earn some money from the natural resources and plow that back into their own people, primarily through education. And then I agree with David Goldwyn that, you know, there you've got the key governance issues. You know, do you really have the governance capacity to take those resources and invest wisely in a way that's going to build up your own people? You know, you want to take the oil in the ground and you want to transform it into an educated, talented population that can live a nice life once the oil in the ground is gone. We haven't seen very many countries that have actually managed that transition.
I'm intrigued by both of your big ideas, trying to end energy poverty, and it's possibly, I think there's a relationship between that and whatever governance system we have internationally for climate change or for reducing carbon emissions. It seems to me that next door there's another conversation going on about energy inefficiency, about efficiency and the here and now. But I imagine there's a lot of wow ideas around light bulbs, about digital use of energy, and all the massive things the developed world can do to save energy, which is significant. For developing nations, the inefficiencies seem to be much more of a challenge and have a lot less to do maybe with some of the consumer adoption and uptake for green technologies that we're going to have in Europe, in the United States. Can you care to respond to that?
Well, I think there's an awful lot of low-hanging fruit in the developing world. I mean, to give you an example, you know, sort of in Russia, we did, when I was in the Department of Energy, we did some work on district heating. The idea of having thermostats and of being able to use some of the excess heat from manufacturing, you know, to channel that into heating for the district was sort of unheard of. The challenge in these places is really twofold. One is it does take upfront capital to make this investment in the thing which is going to produce the efficiency. So you have to muster the capital. And second, you have to have a way to, you know, to implement. You have to know which efficiency strategy there is. And that's where I think the developed world can help look at a situation and say, you know, even, you know, it can be light bulbs, or it can be motion detectors, or it can be thermostats, or it can be moderate changes in pricing. But there are, you know, significant things that you can do that will raise your efficiency. The other thing the developed world can do is actually provide that upfront financing. There are things called ESCOs. They're energy-saving corporations. You put somebody in the business of going to consumers and saying, I'm going to save you money, but I'm going to get a dime on every dollar that I save you, and that's how I'm going to make money.
and they bring the financing, the technology, and they bring in the system. So bringing ESCOs to Africa could be a great way to create jobs and build capacity there. But I think there is low-hanging fruit.
David Dollar, how are we going to, or how is the developing world going to get off of the inefficiency path?
Well, I agree. I do think there are a lot of low-hanging fruit. I'm going to be a bit of a broken record in this session in the sense that I really do think pricing is one key thing. So it's fine to tell consumers you'll save a little bit of money with this change or that, and we do support a lot of that. But as long as energy prices are low, you know, frankly, the incentives for people to change are relatively minor. You know, so if you priced, gasoline is a great example in China. It's primarily the middle class that's buying gasoline to drive cars. So if you significantly tax gasoline, you're going to be mostly hitting the people who are already relatively wealthy, right? You're not going to be hurting the poor in any meaningful sense. You're going to be changing people's driving and living habits if you get them used to a high price of gasoline now. On the other hand, if you have a price below the U.S. price, which is what they have, you're encouraging all these people to buy cars and start driving to work, and you're locking yourself into a lifestyle that's really not going to work for the country.
Now, I don't need to tell you that, of course, the incentive for bringing investments around the world is keeping that threshold low and not looking in terms of tax structures that are going to create a disincentive for investment. How do we square this aspect of the inefficiencies that could be addressed by some type of fiscal arrangement, but yet the markets in terms of trying to reach the developing world really don't want to see, I would imagine, a tax structure overlaying on their desire to try to develop energy in different places around the world?
Right. I would say there in a lot of developing countries, many of the energy prices now are in some explicit or implicit sense subsidized. So for the first step, the energy companies are going to be in the same wavelength with me in that we need some increase in price just to make investments economic and get a financial return. Now, I'm then going to want to go beyond that with taxation because I see these using carbon as having a negative effect, and they're, you know, you're not going to get the big oil companies or the big power companies. Probably we're not going to get them too enthusiastic about taxation. So it's a question of what's in the common good and how you deal with different interest groups that may oppose the common good.
David Goldwyn, will the resource markets produce the correct signals to help solve this problem?
What do you mean?
Is the market going to help set that price on its own? I mean, without individual nations understanding how to set that tax that David Dollar is talking about, can the markets on their own begin to elevate and create the incentives both for the investments, but also so that these energy resources, natural resources, reach more people? One of our fellows from Nigeria said, as a part of this mixed blessing of having an oil resource in Nigeria, is it doesn't reach most of the people, that's the political economic dynamic. Has the market failed to help correct that? I mean, do we have to have a decade or an era where governments are going to have to be vigilant in terms of how these resources are allocated and how the price is set?
Well, the short answer to your question is no. Can markets solve this problem? No. And there's two different problems I think you're talking about. I want to disaggregate them. One is, can markets address this carbon reduction issue, and can markets then drive the right technologies? And I think unless you incorporate the price of the emissions somehow into the system, no, they won't, because coal will still be cheaper. And then the other question is, in terms of oil or gas or things like that, will the markets, you know, in a sense, you know, bring the right resources to bear or bring the right products, I think, in the Nigeria case, to people? And there I think the answer is no, because there are already such distortions in the market. If in a place like Nigeria, you can't make a profit refining gasoline, no one will refine gasoline. Even if the Chinese build a refinery and it's world class, if it costs them a dollar to refine it and they can only sell it for 25 cents, they're not going to stay in business. They'll just say, good luck, somebody else go run it. So you have to create those distortions. But I think the pathway to it isn't just that we're going to raise everybody's taxes, you know, and have strikes that paralyze the economy. Take Nigeria again as an example. Businesses pay an extraordinary amount for the energy they access. They get fuel oil and they burn their own generators. If you ask a business in Nigeria, would you pay a market rate if we guaranteed you that the lights would stay on 24 hours and you would have the money to run their business? They would say absolutely yes, because they are paying. They're paying it because they're going outside the grid in order to do it. And in villages, people are paying also. Sometimes they're paying with their lives, but sometimes they're paying and spending three quarters of their working effort cooking, getting the fuel for cooking. So there is wealth in those villages which can be accessed. And it's not all about raising taxes, it is about market prices. But if you don't fix the distortions, then the answer is no, then you just exacerbate the problems, climate and poverty.
One of the Nigerian fellows that was at the discussion, I think, made this point in the vernacular. He said, you know, when it comes to wanting air conditioning and the refrigerator on, I don't really care what the price is. It's going to go up and up, and we're going to pay it to have that access to make their productivity and other aspects of their lives more likely. Well, what is the responsibility to the developing world vis-a-vis our own security interests and our own we've created this national security fetish, if you will, out of what's going on with global markets, and it's become a driving force in setting both foreign policy and domestic policy. What's our responsibility in the United States, David Dollar?
Well, I think there's another session in the Aspen Week that by Tom Friedman called Green is the New Red, White, and Blue, and I think if he means by this, you know, really developing a much kind of sounder energy policy from the United States, weaning, you know, I happen to be a U.S. citizen, you know, weaning the United States off of such dependence on imported oil and gas, then I agree with Tom Friedman. I think that's a very sensible forward-looking strategy as to, you know, what are the standards and prices that would get America to be less dependent on imported oil and gas. I think that would make this country more secure. I think it would have beneficial effects around the world.
David, I agree with David, but I think, I mean, there's an element of unreality to some of the conversations that I've heard, you know, at Aspen and other places about the difference between the aspiration which everyone shares about not enriching countries that are our adversaries or our competitors, about dealing with emissions. But the real nasty truth is that we are not talking in our Congress or any place else about measures that will actually move the dial. If you're talking about the scale, 20 million barrels a day of oil, huge amounts of emissions, the only way that you can actually make a difference on this national security front is to change the price. David Dollar is exactly right. And in the United States, as long as gasoline, carbon-based gasoline, is cheaper than biofuels or things like that, you know, non-niche companies, big companies, aren't going to invest huge dollars into technologies that are going to reduce carbon. They're going to do what they're doing, is they're going to build coal plants. So we got to change the price of carbon. And oil is a different issue, because if you want car companies to build plug-in hybrids, and, you know, the technology is all there. We can build every kind of car at $200,000 a unit. But if you want commercial scale, then the car companies have to believe, and the oil companies have to believe, that the price of gasoline is never going to go back below $3, and they won't go bankrupt the way they did the last two cycles when oil went to $10, or the Saudis dropped it down to $10. And that means we have to change the price of gasoline and never let it drop. And until we start talking price and doing something about it, all this other stuff, I think, is just window dressing.
I want to open up our conversation to the audience. Before we do that, we've touched only on climate change, and I think that there is a growing consensus that this aspect of markets, of energy supply and demand, are going to become more intimately tied to a carbon-constrained economy, if not on a region-by-region basis, possibly globally. What is that target that you think it will be set, if it were possible?
So I'm not a technical expert on this. I read the same things you read, and I think my sense of the kind of scientific community is going is to try to reduce the emissions by about 50% sometime in the middle of this century. And of course, we'll be talking about a world where the world economy will be much bigger than now, right? It'll probably quadruple relative to today. So to quadruple the economy and reduce energy, you know, carbon emissions by 50%, you just need radically different technologies. And so what are the incentives? You know, put the market to work. What are the incentives they're going to get big companies to be financially viable to invest billions in developing better solar, better wind, much more efficient cars, appliances, et cetera? I mean, I think we can do it, but I don't see the policies in place right now to creating those incentives.
If I can put a dollar price tag on, there's a study by John Deutsch, former Deputy Secretary of Energy, CIA, and Ernie Moniz, a nuclear physicist at MIT. It was on the future of coal. And essentially what they said was that the price of carbon has to be about $30 to be able to generate the market incentive for commercial scale carbon sequestration. and for the poor in the world who all have access to coal, that's the pathway. You can look at a bunch of other technologies, but you've got to set that cap that David Dollar's talking about in a way that gives you a price of carbon that's about $30, and then the market will respond by coming up with substitutes.
Yeah, interesting to me is that we also have science at work around the world, and there, depending on which science scenario model that you agree with, that somewhere at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the concentration levels of CO2 or its equivalent were around 250, 270 parts per million. We're already around 350, I think, moving to 370. And that target for many of them is there's a point of some no return after 450 to 550, and that those create much different scenarios both for the global economy and for the environment depending on which one we set. So far in the policy dialogue, the scientists and some of the advocates are obviously trying to make that a part of the goal, but quickly the policy mechanisms and the economic commentary kicks in and you almost lose sight of the fact that there may be some science helping to determine this question. I can't see very well if there are anyone who has a question out there.
Does this mic work? Yeah. For the world, I think to stop the tipping point that we are both environmentally with climate change and the economy, obviously the U.S. has to provide the most significant, for better or worse, the most significant leadership worldwide. And I don't see within our policy the leadership that's going to come because of the stranglehold that the special interest and shall we say the companies that are driven by other motives. I don't see the lobbyists letting go of our leadership to provide the proper initiatives that will allow real worldwide leadership, U.S. leadership, to occur on this issue. So I'm somewhat fatalistic, and I think I'd like to hear from you something that will help me be more positive, because it really is the stranglehold by the lobbyists and the special interest, I believe.
Okay, so there, in other words, there's a lot of good minds reading some of the signals in terms of what might be possible optimistically, but we do live in there is a political reality where there are special interests, and beyond that, there is concerns with corruption in some of the developing worlds. David, do you want to respond?
Well, I think 2 points of optimism. On oil, actually, I'm quite pessimistic. I can't come up with anything for you. But on environment, I think we're seeing 2 things. One is that environmentalism and carbon reduction has really, I think, become a social movement in this country, and that's kind of what needs to happen. It really, the difference between now and 2 years ago, I think, is really phenomenal in terms of the number of people in different parts of society who think this is an urgent problem. Acceptance of the science, I think, is now pretty much a done deal. The other, I think, a really encouraging factor is that American industry has decided that it needs to know what the future rules of the game are going to be before they make huge investments in infrastructure. And so you've seen this coalition now. You've got GE and Walmart and Target and all these places and power companies that invest overseas and know they're going to be subject to rules. And they're going to the White House saying, enough, accept the science. We need to know what the rules are because we don't want to invest our billions and then have you change them in 5 years. And that, I think, is driving Congress to a system, but this science is a little complex for congressmen, so it's going to take, I think, another year and a half or so, and getting past the election, to figure out what kind of system it is. But I think it'll be the support is bipartisan, and I think 2 years from now, we will have a cap-and-trade system.
Yeah, some of the special interest is changing because some of the special interests are in anticipating a climate regime and wanting to be able to be marketable and profitable in that. David Dollar.
I suggest we take more questions and we avoid the temptation of the
ping pong
comment on everything.
Thank you. My name is Jonathan Kevlis. I am part of the Amory Lovins group down in Old Stone Mass at Rocky Mountain Institute. So I am a believer in energy efficiency, in other words, demand management over supply. Aside from domestic issues, where there's a bias, I think, still of supply over demand management, I'm curious about the policies or politics or access to capital as issues in the developing world that drives a bias towards supply, or if there is a hope for demand management, be it in transportation sector or the power, electricity power sector.
David?
I'll take a shot at that. Right. So I've already said a lot about prices, so I'll try to avoid saying that again. I do think there are other issues. You know, in many parts of the developing world, access to capital is an issue. But, you know, frankly, in China, access to capital is not much of an issue. There's obviously a huge amount of savings, which they're now exporting. I do think information is very important. I think households and firms often lack the basic information. So public information campaigns about, you know, district heating, about appliance efficiency, I do think they play a role. We have a project we're starting in China, $200 million credit line that will go through lots of different small private banks. But the part of it that I'm excited about is not the money, which they frankly don't need. It's basically doing capacity building to train 40 different small private banks about how you do energy efficient investments. So how you can work with a small firm and help them identify the money lying on the ground. You know, there's often a $500 bill lying on the ground that actually, for a relatively small investment, a firm can cut its energy use quite dramatically, often in half, and that's a perfectly sound economic decision. Even with distorted prices in China, that can be a perfectly sound economic decision, but the firm isn't really aware about this, and for small firms to get the information is costly. So I think to develop this as a business line for banks, and if I'm right, it becomes a profitable business line for the banks because they get a lot of good new loans, essentially, that are going to be making investments that improve the cash flow of the firm. So I do think there's a lot that can be done, you know, through the financial system. It doesn't necessarily have to involve a subsidy. It can be more based on information. In some cases, the subsidy is appropriate. So I wouldn't mind some subsidy built into lending through the financial system if it's, you know, actually going to address some externality.
All right, next question.
First, a comment. I'm from Australia. When I take a look at the prices of your petrol here, I think it is ridiculously low. If you compare your prices to Australia or to Europe, for that matter, and then take a look at your car fleet that all of you are driving, I don't know how you can be talking about saving energy. Last year, we visited Libya for a very brief visit. But some of the impressions we had there, I don't know if you've had anything to do with it, but it would be interesting to know the effects of the changes of the distribution of the oil money into the population as a whole. Because what we saw, first of all, the place is filthy. Secondly, it is widely supported with welfare payments, the result of which the government basically has all the work being done with immigrant labor. And the Libyans themselves talk about how pathetic their medical systems are, how pathetic their education systems are. So you've got the problem is enormous, and it varies from country to country. Don't know if you have any comments on a country like Libya.
One, you're right, energy prices are too low, and people thought, you know, $2 was intolerable, and $3 seems to be working all right. It's a leadership issue. I think, you know, on September 12th, the President of the United States has stood up and said, you know, I'm going to need 50 cents a gallon more this year, and a quarter more the next year, and a quarter more the next year, and I'll put it into the payroll tax or energy technologies, and 20 years from now, the countries who are rich today are not going to be rich then. People would have said, yes, sir, thank you. But that moment passed, and so no congressman is going to stand up and raise their hand and say, I want a gasoline tax. I briefed 4 presidential candidates. Let me tell you, you see the whites of their eyes when you raise the word gas tax. You know, so you're right, and you can't really put a dent in the problem when the price is wrong. As oil wealth improved distribution in places like Libya, I actually do a lot of work on Libya. I was there in December. They're spending $25 billion this year building roads, bridges, and things like that in cities, not out of virtue, but basically because that's the way to keep political peace in the country. And they're trying to figure out a way to get Libyans to work because they've never had to. And they brought in Michael Porter from the Monitor Group to talk about how to train them and maybe they'll build schools. But that is a generational challenge. And so what you're going to see is a lot of spending that the World Bank and the IMF thinks is probably a little wasteful now, but you'll see stuff getting built. But around the world, prudent management of oil resources, I'd be hard-pressed to come up with 2 good examples for you now of countries that are using their oil wealth smartly, other than increasingly in the Gulf. where they are building training, they're looking at alternatives, and they're doing portfolio investment. But in the developing world, no, big problem.
Next question.
I'm Swami Iyer from the Cato Institute. It seems to me this discussion is grossly underestimating the power of market forces, is grossly underestimating what rising demand is going to do to the price of energy, and is grossly overestimating what governments are either inclined to do or are going to do. I've been hearing this talk about, you know, how energy prices are low. We really have to put a tax on carbon. While you've been talking and doing nothing, the price of oil went from $18 a barrel to $72 a barrel. So in other words, without the governments doing anything, you don't have to have the government levying a carbon tax. Between OPEC and the market, they have levied a carbon tax, which is infinitely larger than anything politicians could have done. When you look at the future projections, I see that, you know, if you look at the BRIC projections for China, that by 2050, I estimated its oil consumption on any kind of trajectory might go up 15 times. If that was the case, China would consume all the oil that's produced today. Even when I look at the India projections, if you make a straight line projections, India's consumption would be equal to that. It seems to me very clear that as the third world is beginning to grow fast, as David Dollar says, we're growing at a record rate. At this rate of energy rise, I am willing to bet that the price of oil is going to be $200 a barrel in 5 years' time. The price of coal is going to go to $150 a ton. You know, the increases out here are going to be something which completely and totally dwarf these little carbon taxes which you are talking about on the part of governments. So in some ways, what I'm really saying is even if governments do very little, it appears to me that rapid growth in third world countries is going to send fuel prices shooting up to these high levels. The moment oil is at $200 a barrel, solar energy basically becomes so highly economic that everybody gets into it in a massive way. And, you know, saying has been said that one day solar energy is as much as seven times the world energy consumption. Right now, solar energy is uneconomic simply because fossil fuels are still cheaper. It seems to me if you do absolutely nothing, world demand for fossil fuels within 5 to 10 years is going to make solar energy economic, at which point, when you get large-scale solar energy systems coming in, suddenly all the problems start coming down, both in terms of energy and in terms of carbon. So may I say that doing absolutely nothing and just leaving it to the market may actually be a solution.
Great, great question.
Great comment. Can I take this one?
Since we've grossly underestimated the power of the market, how can the do-nothing, invisible hand address this?
Right. So I'm a big fan of market forces, and I accept some of your points that I do think the price of, you know, petroleum is likely to go up, but there are a lot of imperfections in markets, and I can tell you that ordinary Chinese consumers do not buy into your estimate. So, you know, every day in Beijing, another 1,000 cars go on the road, and people are buying relatively fuel-inefficient, petroleum-driven cars. So the ordinary Chinese middle-class person does not see that the price is going to be $200. And I don't see the big gasoline, the big automobile companies investing in new technologies on the assumption that price will be $200. So I hope you're right about the price, but I don't see that the investment and household decisions are always that forward-looking. But even if you're completely right, there's still a problem. I'm very worried about the whole issue of greenhouse gas emissions and global warming. So if the price goes to $200 a barrel, that will affect Chinese behavior. But one of the responses will be to rely even more on coal. China has lots of cheap coal reserves. It can dig up coal at a relatively low price. It can generate power at a relatively low price based on coal. And if there's no concern about greenhouse gas emissions and global warming, then, you know, everything's fine. But the market is not going to take care of that issue. So when I talk about a system of capping greenhouse gas emissions and having tradable permits, that's my way of using the market to take care of an important externality. So I don't see that there's any way to deal with the greenhouse gas emission without bringing in market forces, but we have to create a market for carbon. If I could just give one small example, something I'm proud of, we financed the first big wind power station in China, and the only way we can make this economic is that we sell the carbon that's not used, you know, so there's an emission reduction by using wind instead of coal. We package that, we sell that on the global market, because there is right now a limited market for carbon, and that makes the project economic. If we didn't have this very minor existing global market for carbon, it's not economic to do wind power in China. It's not going to be economic to do solar power, I think, unless we price the carbon emissions. So to me, a cap and trade system is using market forces, but it's recognizing that there are externalities which the pure private market is not going to take care of.
Yeah, just one sentence. The other problem is volatility. Is that you may be able to accurately, or Cato can predict the future accurately, but the problem is that companies have seen the history of oil is that the price goes like this. And so they're not willing to bet that the price is just going to go up and up and up. And what you get with a carbon tax or gasoline or these other taxes is you get some element, you take some of the volatility out, you add predictability in, and you also hurry the day when you get to those new technologies.
Yeah, I think one of the main forces bringing companies, multinationals, and others to the table around carbon management is that very question. At least it may add some level of certainty that right now they feel uncomfortable with. Let's see, next question.
Yeah, I'm Arthur Butambara from Zimbabwe. There have been reference to energy poverty in Africa, and I must say that as African leaders, we must take responsibility for our actions. So we don't blame anybody. We blame ourselves for failure in Africa. But we're doing a few things about it. One, we're trying to build institutions of good governance, building value systems that promote governance and efficiency in our countries. And more importantly, in the economy, we are moving away from our circumstance where we produce what we don't consume and consume what we don't produce. We're saying we're sick and tired of producing raw materials, raw crude oil, raw timber, raw minerals, and then buying teaspoons and buying nails. We want value addition in our economies in Africa. We want beneficiation in Africa, building infrastructure. We want to be producing cars in Africa and selling them to Detroit. We want to be producing computers and selling them to Japan and Malaysia. My question to you as a panel is, what can the Western powers do? What can Western corporations do to help us help ourselves as we pursue the agenda to become globally competitive economies that are producing gadgets and selling them to the world, that are producing gasoline, petrol, and diesel, and selling refined oil products to America as opposed to selling crude oil? What can you do to assist us to become globally, to become your competitors, not suppliers of raw materials?
Yeah, maybe we both want to shout that one. I think it's the framework, because if you want to build something in Africa, you need a road, you need electricity, you need a port, and you need trained labor. And I think what African countries can do is say, is we will create a framework where those things will be here. What the developed countries can do is help you get there. The framework has to come first. But if it is there, then I think if you've got a framework where you can have a power plant, the developed countries ought to provide the financing. If you're willing to build the road that's going to lead from where the plant is to the port, or to build the plant, the World Bank ought to be helping to finance that if you've got the policy framework that will make it economic. And I think giving you good advice on how to set rules for your concessions, so that somebody who comes in to develop the oil or develop the gas or mining or whatever it is also has a responsibility to build that local content, but not what you have right now, which is mandates for local content without the ability for anybody actually to deliver it. But I think if you have that kind of partnership, I think you will see a rush to manufacture in Africa the way you saw the rush to manufacture in China, because you've got inexpensive labor and you've got access to resources. And then you'll see the same lift, hopefully.
David, did you want to comment?
I just welcome your statement very much. I do think development depends primarily on the effort of developing countries, the societies, the government. So I welcome the spirit of your comment. I think that, I think there are different roads to try to approach this. I think history shows that if you try to close off your market in order to protect your domestic industry, I frankly think that's a losing strategy. And I think one of the powerful lessons from China is how you can develop manufacturing in a relatively open environment by creating a good platform, where it's easy to start a firm, where infrastructure works, where people want to do business, where it's profitable to invest in manufacturing. Then you're going to get manufacturing investment.
I will say, just in my limited experience with the African Leadership Initiative, the entrepreneurial spirit in Africa seems to be entering a strong new era. Next question.
Observation and a question. My name is Barry Burkus, architect planner from Santa Barbara. Been involved in research in fuel cells and solar for probably 30 years or 35 years. The first observation is we're sprawling communities. We have a lot of commuters. Those commuters are $6 and $7 an hour commuters as far as their pay scale. in our communities here and in Santa Barbara, these people coming to work can't afford to pay $5 a gallon for gas, or we've really taken an inflation in our communities that's going to really ruin everything. Number one, that's an observation. Number two, in all the research that we've done, every time we get close to a solution, whether it's with Visteon and fuel cells, or whether it's in solar with ARCO, essentially it goes to hell when we don't have any research dollars coming from subsidies in the government. And that if we don't figure out how to store the energy that comes from alternative sources, such as solar, such as wind, and fuel cells, we're going nowhere. And no money that I know right now is being put into the development of batteries and storage systems, which are the most difficult part. We can catch the energy, and we've been able to do it in years through solar and through wind, but we can't store it. Do you have answers to that?
Well, I've emphasized prices a lot, but I want to come back to some other approaches. You know, I do think different types of standards are also important. You know, the two biggest markets for cars in the world now are the U.S. and China. The U.S. and China could collaborate and set enormously, you know, more efficient energy standards. We could say, and it always makes sense to give people time. You know, you say people can't afford to pay to commute. I'm very sympathetic, but you know, you could announce that the prices are phased in over 5 or 6 years to give people time to adjust and buy different types of vehicles. But I also think the U.S. and China could just announce if you want to sell cars in these markets in 2012, you know, they have to average 50 miles per gallon. And if you want to sell cars in these markets in 2020, they have to average 75. We'd need a little bit of science to set reasonable targets. But you can create very powerful incentives for technological innovation, and we can get new technologies that will enable people to commute significant distances but use a lot less energy. So I think, you know, I definitely think there are things we can do on the standard side, which, again, most countries seem to be missing these opportunities. And it's true, a small country can't do this. You know, if France by itself sets an enormously different standard, automobile companies are just not going to produce for the French market. But the U.S. and China together could create incentives that would get all the major car companies, you know, madly working on new technologies. And something I can make a similar point on energy. I have no problem with announcing that if you want to sell power in the U.S., you've got to get 15% of your supply from renewable resources by, say, 2012. You know, you can set standards, and you can give firms 7 to 10 years to adjust, and we'll have a very different kind of energy profile in 7 to 10 years than we have now.
And there, and at least in the United States, there's states that are already on that trajectory to help develop that green tech. I have a question from over here.
Yes, my name is Pam Richards, and I'm interested in sub-Saharan Africa, particularly rural villages and energy delivery to the rural villages. One of the problems I see, of course, is roads, how you get the energy there. The second is cultural, and this may be a completely different subject for discussion. But there was a French group that was trying to deliver water pumps to villages in the Dogon region in Mali. And they had to deal with the role of women in the villages was to collect the water. And the head of the village said, well, we really don't need that because what will women do in our village? So I posed the cultural question of rural Africa and delivering energy to rural Africa.
Good question. I mean, I think it's common knowledge that in sub-Saharan Africa and other places around the world, but especially in Africa, that non-commercial or traditional uses of wood collecting and wood burning related to the environment are a part of the energy structure there. How is that going to...
Well, I think this one might... Yeah? I think you know more about Africa than I do, I think, so...
Well, yeah, there have been hundreds of millions of dollars of failed aid in Africa from basically just throwing technologies into cultural environments where it's not welcome or not understood or not sustained. And so I think there's a couple things. You have to work local to start with and work with villages to address their problems. But I think some of those cultural issues can be overcome. The other is that there are more appropriate technologies. If there's water, there's things like microturbines in the water that provide electricity. But if you work with local leaders, not necessarily with the capital, about what you can bring, about what that will do for health, what that will do for medicine, what that will do for other employment opportunities, I think it's possible to deploy those technologies in sub-Saharan Africa. But if you don't do that, then you have a lot of fancy machines that don't last.
And that follows from your big idea of trying to create some type of goal around ending energy poverty and then finding the appropriate solutions at that scale, which
I'm afraid we won't have time to get into in depth. Nuru?
Nuru from Nigeria. I'm with the Africa Leadership Initiative with an Aspen Fellow. Related to the last question, mine is on rural energy security. Alternative sources of fuel, the most important source of fuel for survival in rural areas, as you've mentioned earlier, about 2.4 billion people in the world cooking with traditional fuel, mainly firewood. Petrol hardly gets to these places. Kerosene is just used to start the fire in the rainy season when the wood is moist. So they're not really tied to what you call the fuel economy, except where it comes to transportation. Their most important resource is their soil and the fertility of their soil. This is an agrarian part of the world where money they make comes from the food they are able to sell. As global warming increases, we are having greater droughts in sub-Saharan Africa. The dry seasons are hotter. Less plants survive the dry season. Then you've got, of course, problems to do with the animals grazing, the carrying capacity having been overstretched. To raise the cost of fuel would raise the cost of transportation. These people can't afford to pay more unless agriculture can give more. They can't afford fertilizer to improve the quality of the soil. There's no enough organic matter to keep the fertility of the soil going, let alone the water to ensure that even if you did have good quality soil, you would have some reasonable harvest. Cultural problems, the cooking methods. Unlike in some parts of Southeast Asia, where the cooking is quite quick, a few minutes and it's all cooked, the cooking methods in most of sub-Saharan Africa are adapted to handle tough meat. So when they cook rice, it's not just cook rice till it's cooked. They cook it till it can become a mushy paste thing. When they cook beef, it's really tough. These are very athletic animals that have been moving up and down. It's not like your one-year-old, two-year-old cattle here. You really have to cook the meat. It consumes a lot of energy. Now, when you put all these together, and the fact that for most Nigerians, even those in urban areas, we're not really we are a democratic society. The people have some power, and they just exhibited it through the labor union when the government wanted to increase the cost of fuel. As you said, just a little rise in the cost of fuel. I'm not saying the government did it in the right way, but the people resisted and will continue to resist. And so long as the reality among the majority is poverty, it's going to be very difficult for a democratic government to get away or to make improvements in the form of increasing the cost of fuel. Meanwhile, you've got deforestation and these people are cutting their firewood and the dry season makes it difficult for any seedlings to survive to the next year. I haven't heard a lot on what's the future of rural communities in this area. Is anybody doing anything? Any success stories anywhere? Any strategies? It just sounds as if the third world, and I'm not excluding myself here, but whenever we discuss about poverty, it's usually related to the poverty on the GDP level, not on the rural poor who are the majority.
Well, that's great commentary, Nuru, and I think you've probably highlighted the need for another dimension to this topic and to this session. But David, did you have a quick response?
Just,
and we'll have one last question.
Two things. One is, no matter what investment happens, biomass is going to be a huge part of the rural economy for years to come. So actually smarter use of biomass, more efficient cook stoves is one big area where I think people can reach and improve the lives of the rural poor right now. And so that has to be a focus. In a place like Nigeria, which when you look at it from outer space, you know, is the second gas flaring is the second brightest source of light in the world next to the eastern seaboard. There's no reason why Nigeria shouldn't have a gas distribution system that will bring electricity and fuel out to the rural areas and particularly through the Niger Delta and create other forms of economic activity. It shouldn't all be kerosene brought in on cars and roads. And that's a place where you're sitting on a huge gas province. So much it's being what's being flared is moving to Ghana through the West Africa gas pipeline to find some place to put it so it can have economic value. That's a big investment project, but I think that's an answer for Nigeria. It may not be for everybody else.
Can we have one last short question? I know you've been waiting patiently.
Hi, Angela Call, one of the Bezos Scholars. First off, I'd like to say thank you and happy, you know, 4th of July to everyone. To the question, the meat industry produces the majority of carbon emissions in the world, and this industry is a large part of the economy, especially in the United States. And you're talking about trying to reduce carbon emissions, but I was wondering if there's anything being done to sort of redesign the meat industry in terms of the environmental effects.
I'm not sure we have an answer.
I'm afraid I think I know absolutely nothing about that. David, other David, do you know anything about this?
I don't know anything about it either.
Well, you've stumped the answer.
I'm surprised to hear the meat industry is the largest source of...
It's some large percentage that I don't want to misquote.
It's a methane thing.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry we couldn't answer your question, and we're running late, but we will note it and try to incorporate it in one of our other sessions. Please join me in thanking our guests, David Dollar and David Goldwyn, this afternoon.